Let me first say how thankful I am to be with you this evening and for Tyler's willingness to swap this Sunday with his, just a lifesaver. I appreciate him and his ability to preach and teach so much, and as well as Kyle being willing to fill in for me in this morning's Bible class. And I'm delighted to be with you here tonight. I want to thank Nick for the songs that he led this evening, and also blame him because he didn't give me the straw that Colby told him to give me on Wednesday night. It would have cut the duration of this sickness down in half. I'm confident of that. If he would have just recognized the impact of that decision and given me that straw. But I do certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. Last Sunday, April Fool's Easter, I introduced this series on "I have played the fool." These words of playing the fool are the words of the first king of Israel, as he had worked against David and sought to kill him without any just cause. We talked about that on Sunday, and recognized some things with that. And so we asked, walk through this series of ways that we can be. We asked the question, how is it that I might play the fool today? And so we walked through 3 points that dealt with the way we can become fools today. And we're going to add another point to that. Nick mentioned one about wealth, and I'm going to actually bypass that this evening, pass over that, and might just barely wade into that so that we'll deal with that next Sunday with some other points that we're going to talk about. I mean, you think about the subject of fool. The Bible really does have this contrast between the wise man and the foolish man. And it is a contrast that is stark. It is a contrast that is clear. And so we're going to be looking at some more things. And about 7 of these points resonate from the Scriptures, that we look at the one who's playing the fool. And we talked about last Sunday morning how the one who abandons the gospel for the law of Moses. Remember, Paul said, "O foolish Galatians, these people were playing the fool by mixing in statures of Old Testament law, tenets of the law of Moses, into the hearing of faith, into the gospel." We dealt with that. We looked at the two systems. We show from Galatians what he was talking about. And then we made the application. What would Paul consider those who today not only mix in Old Testament law, which at one point was authorized, which at one point was binding, but then they grab tenets of paganism and throw that into the umbrella of Christianity? Hence Easter. That's what that is. The bringing in of different things. Old Testament, paganism, and New Testament, kind of mixing it all together as a package. We showed that that's playing the fool. Were they playing the fool? Who has bewitched you? We looked at a man who despises his father's instruction. A fool despises his father's instruction, but he who receives correction is prudent. We dealt with the need that typically a father provides for his son, that a father typically has the best interest for his child. 3, we looked at the one who hears God's word but does nothing. He doesn't do anything. Jesus addressed this with, again, the two builders, the wise man who built his house on the rock and the foolish man who built his house on the sand. Even though they heard the same message, they both built houses, they both had the same solutions. One withstood the storms while the other faded away in disaster. And that was all because one heard and did, as opposed to hearing and doing nothing. But let's add to that list tonight a man who is wise in his own eyes. A person who thinks that he himself is the gift of wisdom. You know, in the context here of Proverbs 26, we didn't go all the way to verse 1, but if you start in verse 1, you see that snow and summer and rain and harvest, so honor is not fitting for a fool. And he's talking about this fool, all the way up. And we come to this apex in verse 12, where we see a man who is wise in his own eyes. This, there is more hope for the fool than him. This man is playing the fool, obviously, but he's actually below the fool. He's actually worse than the fool. And you know, so we think about the guy playing the fool tonight as a person who is wise in his own eyes. And there's so many scriptures that we could run before us as we think about this. But, you know, here's three. Proverbs 12, verse 15. The way of the fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise. Proverbs 28, 26. He who trusts in his own heart is a fool, but whoever walks wisely will be delivered. Proverbs 14, 12, there's a way that seems right to a man, but his end thereof is the way of death. Now, how many times have we done something that we thought was right and thought was good, only to find out that we were disastrously mistaken? The decisions that we made that were wrong. It's kind of like a Chinese proverb. My wife, you know, when we go out to eat, she always gets the ones that smash her, thrash her, condemn her and discipline her. And I always get the peachy ones, like, you're going to be really successful if you just, I don't know why that is. But she always gets these ones that are instructive, and I always get the ones that are softies. And the one she got was, do not do what you should, but do what is right. And I think the idea here is that man often determines what he should do apart from what is right. There is a way that is right to a man. It's not right to God. He thinks this is the way he should go, but its end is the way of death. I should attend that church that is really close to me. It's kind of the prevailing wisdom of the world. What church is closest to my residence? And the church that is closest to my residence, that is the church that I will attend. And that's not necessarily the wise man's decision, because, you know, it's basing it on proximity and not on truth. Or you might think of the prevailing wisdom that I heard when I was a young man. You need to live with a woman before you marry her. That is what you should do, but that's not really what the Bible teaches is wise and true. That cuts against the standard of morality that's found and defined in Scripture. Or I should sow my wild oats before I get too much older. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to miss the good life of having all this fun before I settle down and tie myself down in Christianity. The one woman that made that comment to me is now dead. She's been dead for years. She was young. She thought she had a whole lot of life left in her, and her life ended very rapidly one night with an accident in front of a Mack truck. And she left behind not only the chance of getting her soul corrected with God, but her chance of bringing up her children, her two precious children, in the ways of the Lord as well. I should take that higher paying job, even though it will mean I will miss out on services frequently. And so these are those kinds of decisions, as Tyler preached about this morning, the impact of a single decision or indecision can be filled with extreme ramifications. Now, these passages do not stand alone. We can think of here in Jeremiah chapter 10, 23, O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps. I told Nick that I was going to be preaching or going to be quoting a whole lot of men tonight. He goes, well, the wisdom of men. I said, exactly. When you look at the wisdom of men and you contrast it with the wisdom of God, it stands apart. Man has an impressive ability to show that he is not God. He has an impressive ability to become, to show his inept quality of predicting the future. We see that in ways we laugh about with the weather. But it's not just that. You know, about 2,000 years ago, a man named Ptolemy thought that the universe revolved around the earth. Was he right? But it wasn't about until 500 years ago that people began to think maybe the world is not flat, right? So there's progress. But let's get a little bit closer to time. It used to be held by the medical community that to cure a disease, you must drain the blood. Were they right? That is the attributing cause to George Washington's death. Let's keep walking a little further. Thomas Jefferson did not believe in meteorites coming from the sky. And he said this, "I will sooner believe that two Yankee professors lied than that stones fell from the sky." Do stones fall from the sky? They can. You see, man does not have the capability of knowing all things and understanding all things. And then there is the Sir William Preece, chief engineer of the British Post Office in 1878, who said the Americans have need of the telephone, but we do not. We have plenty of messenger boys. Where is that today? Where is that seen today? Messenger boys? In 1899, the patent office president thought that everything had been invented and he was taking on the notion of closing it down. Has anything been invented since 1899? Can you think of anything at all that's been invented since 1899? Well, let's walk a little bit further. Napoleon Bonaparte, in talking about Robert Fulton's steamboat, said, "How, sir, would you make a ship sail against the wind and currents by lighting a bonfire under her deck? I pray you excuse me, I have not the time to listen to such nonsense." But then British novelist H.G. Wells in 1901 said, "I must confess that my imagination refuses to see any sort of submarine doing anything but suffocating its crew and floundering at sea." These were well-respected, wise people who today have quotations that are laughable because they don't know all things, they haven't been everywhere, and they can see that there's a way, but they can't direct it. And so with God, when he makes predictions that are hundreds or even thousands of years old, they come to pass. But man has that incapability of predicting things even in the near future. Albert Einstein, as a young boy, was a slow learner. His parents worried that he had an intellectual issue. Now, when we call someone, "Well done, Einstein," we're using that in a similar way that we would say genius, right? But his parents thought that he had an intellectual disorder. Albert Einstein, they thought, may have had, or some have observed, that he may have actually had dyslexia or another Asperger's syndrome. He didn't start speaking until he was 4 years old. And one place said he wasn't even fluent in that until he was 9. His teacher, one of his teachers, told his father that it doesn't matter what he'll do, he'll never amount to much. Was he right? Albert Einstein, in talking about his theory of relativity, related it to his slowness in being able to develop into time with his language communication. And so what would we say about Albert Einstein today? Simon Newcomb said this, "Flight by machines heavier than air is unpractical and insignificant, if not utterly impossible." But even Wilbur Wright, 2 years before he flew, said flying would be about 50 years down the road. So he broke his own prediction. Again, man may make attempts at seeing things and saying things, but that doesn't mean that they are correct. There is the story of the Michigan Savings Bank advising Henry Ford's lawyer, Horace Rackham, not to invest in the Ford Motor Company in 1903. He said, "Automobiles are a fad. The horse is here to stay." Was he right? How many of you rode your horses here today? No, your horses are under your hood, right? Well, this man didn't listen to, this lawyer didn't listen to him. Even though he's a banker, he bought 5,000 worth of stock and sold it later for $12.5 million. Again, there is a way that seems right to a man. Remember the Titanic? Oh, we built the unsinkable ship. Then what happens? The bottom of the sea. In 1927, Henry M. Warner, who should know something about theaters, said that people don't want to hear actors talk. So imagine building a theater today without actors talking. Now, that would actually be a good thing. With some of the things that are shown today, there are a whole lot of actors I would not want to hear talk. But generally, imagine building a theater without sound. Would that work? W.C. Hooper, the National Cancer Institute, said if excessive smoking actually plays a role in the production of lung cancer, it seems to be a minor one. Minor one. Today it's known that 80 to 90% of all lung cancer patients, it's linked to smoking. He was right, 1954. Then you got Charles Darwin's grandson, Sir Charles Darwin, who said in 1946 that it is very possible that one machine would suffice, talking about computers, one machine, one computer, would suffice to solve all the problems that are demanded of it from the whole country. Please resign your iPads and your smartphones and your personal computers and your laptops, please. One computer is all that's needed for all the problems of one country. Was he correct? He evidently couldn't predict forward any better than his grandfather could predict to the past about evolution. In fact, when you think about computers, Ken Olson, the president, chairman, and original founder of Digital Equipment Corp., argued in 1977 that there's no reason why anybody would want to have a computer in their home. Popular Mechanics before that said there'll be a time when computers weigh less than 1.5 tons. Now you carry them in your pocket. So here are quotes of men, the wisdom of men that only later show is shown to be foolish. Sometimes they were, you know, scholars within their own field. They were looked up to by men. Today, people look up to their professors. They look up to the institutions. And they say, oh, there's not a God. It's all a product of time and chance. You know where we'll go near the end of this series? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So, computers, you know, weather, ships, horse and buggy, automobiles, technology, wherever you go, you find man's inability to predict the course in which it will go. But you know what? It reminds me of this passage in Isaiah 58, verse 8 and 9. My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. How high are God's thoughts? It'd be like being in outer space looking out versus you and me who's on the surface trying to see. We predict and we say and we think and we do things based without the eye of God, based without the wisdom of God, only to be left naked as fools. In Isaiah chapter 26, verse 7, the way of the just is upright. O most upright, you weigh the path of the just. The way of the just is where its uprightness. The upright look at that which is upright. So their decision making, their judgment making, their conduct of their lives are based on what is upright itself. But who's the source of that? Oh, most upright, you weigh the path of the just. And that gets me to another point here. That God does weigh us. He measures what we measure. He weighs what we weigh. You know, it's easy for you and me to make a decision when we think we're not going to be held accountable for that decision. It's easy for you and me to make a decision when we think nobody's watching. Nobody will see it. It won't have any impact anywhere else. But when we have to own the decision, now all of a sudden the decision is not so easy. But let me tell you this, that every decision that we make, if we are the upright, we lay those decisions before God Himself to weigh. And so we ought to measure every waking decision, large or small, by what is weighed by God Himself. And it's often the smaller decisions that come into play. It's often the little things that define my character, the things that I will do that are small. It's not always the big things, but it's the small things that are done when no one's looking. The choice that I make to watch a specific kind of movie defines a little bit the type of character that I have. The choice to wear the type of clothing that I wear, again, defines the character that I have. The choice of recreation, to choose, you know, what I'm going to do, the recreation itself. It's recreational to me, but is it right? The places that I go to recreate, is there a faithful church there? Those decisions define my character. One who stayed home this morning, the choice to stay home and not come to services. That can define the character. I understand, you know, we understand they're limiting, hindering causes. I'm not talking about that. You know what I'm talking about. But simply because, you know, I've got friends that come over, or I got family visiting today, and they've driven, you know, a few hours to come and see me, and so therefore I make the decision to stay home rather than come and worship my God. These decisions define who I am. The type of spouse that I choose to marry defines who I am. Hence, we need God, the upright one, to measure our decisions, and we need to measure our decisions based on His judgments as well. You'd open your New Testament to Luke chapter 16. In Luke chapter 16, we have a parable here of what Jesus spoke of the unjust steward. And you know, one of the bad things about chapter divisions is that we isolate what's in chapter 16 with chapter 15, or chapter 15 from chapter 5. That's one of the bad things about chapter divisions. Generally, though, I'm a total fan of chapter divisions and of breaking down the chapter into verses. But understand this, chapter 16 is an extension of chapter 15. And in chapter 15, the parable of the two sons, they had a certain kind of idea about their father's estate. Right? The one son, I want what's mine. He took it and he wasted it on prodigal living. And the other son, I've been so faithful and now you never have any parties for me. But it's all revolving around the father's estate. And these teachings are revolving around something further back in the background. Not the two sons, but what's in verse 1 and verse 2 of chapter 15. All the tax collectors and the sinners drew near to him. There was a drawn influence by the people of the world, and some of these were rich people of the world. They were tax collectors. Some of them were very immoral people as well, and they are drawn to Christ here in verse 1. And the Pharisees are saying this in verse 2, that they complain, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." This is why Jesus spoke these parables. This is why he spoke the first three parables, which are all about that which is lost and something that is found. But then he speaks this fourth parable to the tax collector himself, to his disciples. Notice verse 16. He also said to his disciples, not just the apostles here, he's talking to these sinners and these tax collectors that are coming to him and wanting to be drawn to this way. And he's teaching them about the power and influence of wealth and the way they need to view Christ. And so, you know, this kind of leads in where we'll go next week, Lord willing. But there's an emphasis pointed out here in chapter 16 in this parable that it's how we make our decisions here in verse 10. Notice in verse 10, he who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. You see that principle? I mean, it just glares from the stage to me. It glares from this page. It stares at me. And I see myself there. If you're faithful in what is little, then you'll be faithful in what is a lot. But if you're unfaithful in what is little, that would be like mammon of the world. If you're unfaithful in the wealth of this world, then you will also be unfaithful in what is great, things pertaining to God. And so we have here in this parable a man who is seen to be shrewd in that as a worldly person, he knows how to do things pertaining to his master over him as well as his tenants under him. And in order to gain security, he pleases the tenants under him by saying, cut it in half, and then he'll receive his security. Jesus is pointing out the sons of this light, the sons of the light, they don't have that kind of wisdom in pertaining to their Father in heaven. If you're tied to riches, if you're tied to the love of money, you don't have the same kind of wisdom in pleasing God, your master, or your brethren, so that you can receive homes of security. And so he tells them, he was faithful in what is little is faithful in much. He says, therefore, if you have not been faithful in unrighteous mammon, who will commit your trust with the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve. And this is directed at these tax collectors and sinners in verse 1. No servant, and this is the point of the parable, you cannot serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. There is playing the fool. God does not judge, as J.W. McGarvey said so long ago, by the magnitude of the act, but by the spiritual principles and motives which lie in the back of the act. A small action may discover and lay bare these principles quite as well as a large one in the administration of small properties entrusted to us on the earth. We reveal our disposition and temper as stewards quite as well as if we owned half the universe. Faithful in what is little, faithful in what is much. You know, there's an example of this, several examples. Remember Judas? Go ahead and turn there in John chapter 12. In John chapter 12, verse 4, it says, then Mary took a pound of very costly oil, this is verse 3, and she laid this on Jesus' feet, right? Wiped it with her hair. And then verse 4, it says, one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? Is Judas being fair here? Or is Judas also, like the parable of the rich steward, the unjust steward, is he also being unfaithful in what is little? Well, what does the record say here? He said that, verse 6, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box and he used to take what was put in it. He's unfaithful with what is little. He's taking dibs out of the money box. And if you're unfaithful in what is little, we don't often think of how Judas broke that commandment. How he stole from the money box. When you think of Judas, what do you think of? The betrayal of Jesus Christ. But what does this teach us when we combine these passages together? Because his character is defined not at the betrayal of Christ. His character is already defined here. He's unfaithful. He's a betrayer. He can't be counted on with what is little. And so what does he do to the Lord? Willing to sell him for 30 pieces of silver. And so these things, the weight of our decision and the foolishness that the world would put on us, if we think that we're all there is to know and we think we have all the answers apart from God, we are only playing the fool. Only playing the fool. So, you know, we read in Matthew chapter 24 this exhortation here to be ready. Jesus tells the folks that I'm coming at a time that you do not know. He tells them in chapter 24 here, in verse 42, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour the Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would have come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready. The Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Underscore that. He's coming at an hour you do not expect. Jesus picks back up on this theme in chapter 25, that the Lord is coming at an hour that you can't predict. Remember, they couldn't even predict flight. It's going to be 50 years and it's in 2 years, right? You can't predict when Jesus is coming again. Jesus picks this up at what we call the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. And the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. Much like we ended last week with the wise builder versus the foolish builder in Matthew chapter 7. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. Tyler talked about decisions. Think of that decision in verse 3. Taking lamps, but then taking no oil. Versus taking the lamps and then taking the oil. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept, and at midnight a cry was heard. Behold, the bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him. And all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, no, lest there not be enough for us and you, but rather go to those who sell and buy for yourselves. You notice verse 10? While they went to buy. They went to buy. When did they go to buy? Midnight. There weren't Walmarts open back then. They actually took the advice to go out and buy when nobody's going to be selling at this hour. This is the most inopportune time to buy because when it was the opportune time, they met it with indecision to be ready. Hence, when the bridegroom comes, they're on the outside saying, Lord, open to us, verse 11, after the door was shut. And his response is, I do not know you. And then he reiterates what we saw in chapter 24. Watch therefore, for you do not know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. And if anybody ever tells you they know the day and the hour, do not listen to them, or you'll be playing the fool with them as well. None of us know the day of the week nor the hour of that day in which he will come. And if you can't know the hour, how can you know the day? And if you can't know the day, how can you know the month? And if you can't know the month, how can you know the year? People make these predictions all the time. In vain, 100%. If you're not a Christian tonight, you can't know when the Lord will come, but you can make the decision to bring your lamps and your oil, in case he comes tonight. That is done by obeying the gospel. You're subject to the invitation. Repent of your sins today. Receive his mercy and grace from on high by being baptized into his blood for the remission of sins, as together we stand and as we sing.